From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Florida lawmakers were scheduled to wrap up their session a week from today, but that's not happening.
The fiscal health of our state is at risk.
Also this week, the leading Democrat in the Florida Senate is dropping his party affiliation while insisting the move isn't driven by self-interest.
Even my worst detractors have no valid claim that I can be bullied, that I can be bought, or even borrowed for a special interest.
We'll also look at Florida's teacher shortage, possible help for condo owners, and how quickly the kids of immigrant parents adopt English as their first language. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end of week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee.
Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. HR Florida State Council, affiliate of the Society of Human Resource Management, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 16,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council. More at hrflorida.org. The Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com.
We start off with the expanded follow-up to a story that broke late yesterday afternoon, with the Senate and House unable to reach a deal on tax cuts and spending. Lawmakers will not finish negotiations on a new state budget in time to end the legislative session as scheduled next week. Senate President Ben Albritton and House Speaker Daniel Perez told their members that leaders have not reached agreement on key first steps that are needed to start formal budget negotiations. The House and Senate passed budget proposals this month with a more than $4 billion gap. The House's proposal totaled $113 billion, while the Senate's weighed in at more than $117 billion. Speaker Perez says the Senate has not been willing to move closer to the House's leaner budget proposal.
This state legislature has become addicted to spending money, and if we don't admit that we have a problem and get help, the fiscal health of our state is at risk.
Albritton says the Senate is concerned about making deep recurring budget cuts because of potential shortfalls in future years.
I am committed to passing historic, unprecedented tax relief. However, it won't be at the expense of the long-term financial stability of our state.
A major difference has centered on tax cuts. The House has proposed a tax package totaling about $5 billion, with the cuts largely stemming from a plan to permanently reduce the state's sales tax rate from 6% to 5.25%. The Senate proposed a $1.83 billion tax cut package that includes eliminating sales taxes on clothing. It would also offer a series of sales tax holidays. Lawmakers must pass a budget before the July 1st start of the 2025-2026 fiscal year. The prospect of lawmakers missing their scheduled sign-e-die date wasn't the only bombshell coming out of the Capitol. Former Florida Senate Democratic leader Jason Pizzo announced yesterday he's switching his party affiliation to NPA, or no party affiliation. Tristan Wood reports the move is being blasted by Democrats and comes as Pizzo has been signaling he'll run for governor in 2026.
During his statement on the Senate floor, Pizzo said the Florida Democratic Party is, in his words, dead.
Our constituents are craving practical leaders, not political hacks. We are entrusted to be guided by our conscience, and while I suppose it's easier in theory than it is in application, even my worst detractors have no valid claim that I can be bullied, that I can be bought, or even borrowed for a special interest.
Pizzo has said he's considering a run for governor. He's also been saying for months he believes his party has gone too far to the left. Here he is just before the start of this year's legislative session.
I don't want, nor is it necessary, nor is it important, nor is it pressing, to talk about transgender high school athletes, CRT, woke, AP African, all this. A loud deflection and distraction from actually rolling up our sleeves and taking care of the issues that are most important to families.
Pizzo's change of party came the same day former Republican Congressman David Jolly announced he is registering as a Democrat and considering a run for governor. Florida Democratic Party Chair Nikki Fried wrote in a statement she thinks Pizzo's switch is because he failed to build support for a gubernatorial run. Orange County Democratic Party Chair and DNC member Samuel Vilches Santiago agrees with Fried's take. While he says the Democratic Party does need work, he believes Pizzo's ambition is what drove his decision.
But at this moment in history where, you know, our democracy is being attacked, where fascism is being, you know, spread across the state and across the country, the Democratic Party is a vessel for positive change, both at the national level and at the state level. And, you know, this decision by Senator Pizzo, again, by throwing the party under the bus in a way, puts his own interests of wanting to be governor ahead of what the people and our democracy need at the moment.
One person who has frequently been the focus of Pizzo's criticisms is Orlando Democratic Representative Anna Escamani. She says the Democratic Party isn't the place for those who aren't willing to work collaboratively.
And I do think it's better to not have individuals that are more focused on self-preservation and self-expansion versus the greater good of trying to rebuild a party and carry us into a future that does reflect our diversity, it does reflect the values of working class people, and does center on solving problems versus creating chaos.
Pizzo's move comes at a time when there are fewer Democratic state senators in the legislature than any other time over the last dozen years. Leon County Democratic Party Chair Ryan Ray placed a portion of the blame for that on Pizzo, for what he believes is a lack of enthusiasm he had in challenging races for his caucus.
You know, I think if anything, the lousy shape that the caucus is in is because of his inactions. It seems like he's saying that the Senate Democratic Caucus isn't working well, and everyone's dysfunctional and mad at him, and yet he's the one that's been pulling the strings and making these machinations and making these deals.
This Democratic Party fight has made many Republicans happy. Republican Party of Florida Chair Evan Power says Pizzo is right that Democrats have gone too far left.
More and more people, even inside the Democratic Party, know that the fringe that is now leading the Democratic Party is out of step with Floridians and Americans, and I think he sums it up correctly when he said the Florida Democratic Party is dead.
But Power says he thinks a potential gubernatorial bid from Pizzo is dead on arrival.
I don't think there's a future for anyone who's not a Republican to win a statewide race in Florida for probably the next decade.
Governor Ron DeSantis beat Democrat Charlie Crist by almost 20 points in 2022. The Republican lead in voter registration over Democrats has also stretched to over a million and is still growing. I'm Tristan Wood.
Coming up on Capitol Report, Florida lawmakers scramble to address the state's growing teacher shortage.
This bill is designed to help train the next generation of educators.
There's pushback aplenty for a bill that would require students to see videos of fetuses in the womb.
Are we using public education to advance a particular political or moral message?
Florida condo owners are still waiting for lawmakers to agree on a plan to cut the rising cost of condominium association fees.
So many of our seniors and also young families could not afford to increase the condo fees in their reserves, so this bill finally gives them an option.
And it seems it doesn't take the children of immigrants long to get away from their parents' native tongue.
People who are born here and go to schools here, those folks, paradoxically, end up being English-dominant bilinguals or English-monolinguals.
State leaders are concerned about running out of teachers in Florida. Now, a bill intended to address that shortage has passed the House. It would begin the process of aligning the core principles, standards, and content of Florida's different types of teacher preparation programs. Margie Menzel reports.
This bill is designed to help train the next generation of educators.
That's Zephyr Hills Republican Senator Danny Burgess, the bill's Senate sponsor.
I believe this bill is necessary because 1 in 10 Florida courses lacks a properly trained and certified teacher. 15% of courses in low-performing schools are taught by out-of-field teachers, and Florida needs 9.7% more teachers by 2031, but fewer college graduates are choosing the educational pathway through the traditional four-year degree program.
Teacher preparation programs are accountable for producing teachers with the competencies and skills to achieve Florida's education goals. They're offered by public and private post-secondary institutions, public school districts, and private providers. At the same time, Burgess says, alternate paths to becoming a teacher are growing more popular.
While this is a good thing, it also shows that the current system is considered a bit cumbersome, maybe not what those are seeking to pursue. And so we want to look at ways to grow the desire to become an educator, because we believe it's one of the most noble professions in public service.
The bill requires the State Department of Education to develop a new Florida Teacher Excellence Examination. It also puts new core curricula in place for teacher certification programs. And it would create the Competency-Based Coaching for Educator Readiness and Teaching Program, known as CERT, as an alternative path to certification through on-the-job mentorship and evaluation. And after the CERT program is implemented, which won't happen until 2029, it will replace two other professional competency programs.
The implementation date for this new program is July 1st, 2029.
Hialeah Republican Representative Alex Rizzo, the bill's House co-sponsor, says it'll take years to do everything the bill requires.
And so we have lots of time to go ahead and make sure that everything is right before this plane that we're creating in the hangar that we're building from the ground up takes off and we land the current certification plane on June 30th of 2029.
While the measure has bipartisan backing, some language in the bill sparked passionate debate on the House floor. It bans teacher preparation courses from teaching that systemic racism, sexism, or other forms of oppression are inherent in the institutions of the United States. Port Orange Republican Representative Chase Tremont taught history for 10 years and is now a pastor. He says he doesn't think teacher training courses should include discussions of issues like systemic racism.
And I remember the ideological training that I received when I was a school teacher in one of our mandated teacher training seminars. And if I didn't have enough life experience under my belt and a rock-solid education and a true unfiltered and unbiased understanding of our history, I may have succumbed to some of those beliefs that were forced upon us.
Miami Democratic Representative Ashley Gant, an attorney, is also certified to teach history and English.
And history was my favorite because you can't change what happened.
She argues discussions on systemic racism, sexism, and oppression have a place both in teacher training materials and in the classroom.
You can't. You can teach students how to look at it critically and how to make decisions on what type of person that they want to be going forward based on what has happened and look at our country. Because, listen, I believe in the American dream, even though my people were once currency in this country.
Despite concerns about that portion of the bill, the House passed the measure 84-27 on Tuesday. The Senate companion is on the special order calendar. I'm Margie Menzel.
A bill that requires public school students to watch two high-definition videos on fetal development from conception until birth passed the Florida House this week. WMNF's Chris Young reports the bill's sponsor says opponents believe it may be used for indoctrination.
The bill would require, among other things, students to watch two videos, a one-minute ultrasound video and a three-minute fertilization and human development video from conception until birth. Republican Representative Dana Trabolsi sponsored the bill. She says the bill wouldn't require a popular but controversial video to be shown. The video is called Baby Olivia and is backed by anti-abortion and Christian organizations. Instead, she says the video would be up to the State Board of Education. But Gainesville Democratic Representative Yvonne Hinson voted against the bill, saying she and members of the public have questioned the video requirements.
I really thought that the sponsor had taken that video out of the bill, and that is what she promised to do and did not. This raises a serious question, though. Are we prioritizing science and medically accurate depictions, or are we using public education to advance a particular political or moral message?
But Tampa Republican Representative Susan Valdez, a former Democrat, praised the bill.
So I just wanted to highlight the great work that Representative Trevolsi has done on this bill. Her integrity speaks for itself. You listened, you heard, and you delivered.
It passed 86-27 in the House. I'm Chris Young.
Legislation that aims to bring financial relief to condominium owners in Florida has cleared the House floor, but final action is still pending in the Senate as that chamber's members went home early for the weekend. Lawmakers on both sides say their measures address rising fees in condo associations, specifically from those near the coast. Adrian Andrews reports some differences remain between the two proposals.
Following the 2021 Surfside condo collapse, the Florida legislature passed laws requiring condo associations to make routine inspections and keep reserve funds for structural repairs. But those laws brought unintended consequences to some condo owners, who are now struggling to fund those reserves. Owners say their associations are raising their fees to help cover repairs. DeSantis has long been pushing lawmakers to come up with a solution.
Let's recognize that these consequences are not what we want, and let's provide reforms to be able to keep people in their condo units.
DeSantis made his comments during a press conference on April 10th. Weeks later, the House passed their proposal. The bill's sponsor, Miami Republican Representative Vicky Lopez, says it gives condo associations the option to secure loans for improvements versus building up reserves.
So many of our seniors and also young families could not afford to increase the condo fees in their reserves, so this bill finally gives them an option.
Under the measure, only condos that are at least three stories high will need to have the reserve, and they must comply with the existing inspection requirements or lose access to state-backed property insurance. House lawmakers also say their measure allows condo owners to participate more easily in decisions about their condo by giving owners an electronic voting option, which 25% of owners must agree on. DeSantis at his press event disagreed with the measure, saying, quote, it puts the interest of developers over the interest of Florida residents.
It does not provide more flexibility for associations to phase funding for certain components of the structural integrity reserve study.
But DeSantis says he does like the Senate plan to fix the state's condo crisis. Both bills aim to provide financial relief, but the Senate's version focuses more on allowing condo associations to pause reserve fund contributions. Their version also includes specific provisions for data collection and reporting, whereas Lopez's bill does not. Alachua Republican Senator Jennifer Bradley is sponsoring the Senate bill.
I'm telling you, this is landmark legislation that finally does provide the relief, the financial relief, that all of our condo owners deserve.
Governor DeSantis says he prefers the Senate's version. Both chambers would have to work out their differences and pass a bill that has the same exact language before the end of session. I'm Adrian Andrews.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Florida, particularly South Florida, has become a melting pot of languages. Sherilyn Cabrera with WLRN took a deep dive into the swirling cross currents.
If you're Latino in the U.S., you may have heard of the term No Sabo Kid. It's a label, sometimes a joke, sometimes a jab, for someone whose Spanish isn't perfect or maybe doesn't speak it at all. It comes from the incorrect way of saying I don't know in Spanish, no sabo, instead of no sé. and it's often used to question how connected someone is to their culture. Here in South Florida, it's a common experience for second and third generation Latinos. To discuss what it means to be a Nosabo kid, I spoke with Florida International University linguistics professor Philip Carter. Among millennial and Gen Z Latinos, the term Nosabo kid has become a hot topic, at least on social media. For some native South Floridians that I spoke to recently who consider themselves Nosabo kids, this is how they define it.
I feel like usually their mom talks to them in Spanish and they respond in English. I'm sure if they really tried, they could get a sentence out and it could be correct. But I feel like the Nosabo kid is very hesitant in speaking because of a shame that comes with making a mistake.
Someone who appears to be Latino, or at least people perceive them to be based on how they look or their customs or where they're from, but just doesn't speak the language.
You have all the cultural aspects. You have all of the food, the music, the customs, everything, but you don't have the language.
That was Patricia from Weston, Joey, who grew up in Kendall but is now in Washington, D.C., and Anna from Miami. Now, Philip, based on your research and findings, what do you think when you hear these definitions of a Nosabo kid?
They're putting their finger on the experiences of millions and millions of people who exist somewhere on what linguists call the bilingual continuum. The idea that on one pole you have people who are Spanish monolinguals, on the other end there's English monolinguals, and maybe in the middle you speak both in the exact same way. But most people are somewhere in the middle. And I think when we talk about Nosabo kids, we forget that knowing a language is also comprehending. It's not only actively producing, it's also, can I listen and respond in another language? Why is that not knowing Spanish? Being able to overhear and understand, or being able to hear a joke and laugh at it. All of that is a part of the bilingual continuum, and linguists sometimes call that asymmetrical bilingualism or passive bilingualism, but that forms part of the Nosabo phenomenon.
And what do you think about this term, Nosabo kid?
I think it's, quite frankly, a brilliant way to name a social phenomenon, saying we refuse the derogatory term Nosabo. We refuse that and we reclaim that because we understand that our not being able to speak Spanish in the way that you expect us to is not our fault.
People who are not Latino or who have never heard of the phrase before get confused with the kid part of it, but you don't have to be a kid or child to be considered a Nosabo kid.
Yeah, because this refers to any person who has the experience of being told, don't speak Spanish or speak it in this way, you're doing it incorrectly, and then being shamed for saying it the wrong way, and then kind of opting out, like saying, receiving that message and saying, okay, fine, you don't want me to speak Spanish, I'm not going to speak Spanish. Or I'm not going to speak Spanish because I don't want to, I don't feel comfortable if you're then going to bully me for it or harass me for it or make fun of me for it or whatever. And then later on down the line, tell me that I'm now flawed for not speaking it perfectly. So that can be obviously a person who is a literal child or anyone who grew up with that experience and enters adulthood still having those feelings. The pattern of cross-generational language shift is not unique only to Spanish. That has happened with all languages other than English in the United States. Italian, Polish, Yiddish, German, French, all of those communities have had a version of this in their moment. That's a phenomenon that is really unique to the United States. Linguists call the United States a language graveyard.
So according to the Pew Research Center, as of 2021, 72% of U.S. Hispanics and Latinos ages 5 and older either spoke only English at home or spoke English very well, up from 65% in 2010. During that time, both U.S.-born and immigrant Hispanics and Latinos became more proficient in the language. Has this change coincided with the emergence of this Nosabo kid expression?
Yeah, for sure, because the more that the pattern of cross-generational language shift, that's the pattern of, okay, so a family starts bilingual but Spanish dominant, then in generation two, maybe it's a little bit more mixed, and already by generation three, it's more English dominant. And that's happening at the level of individuals, but also in homes and in the community. So there's these two trajectories that are moving in parallel. And so the more we move into English dominance in individuals and homes and communities, the more that this Nosabo phenomenon is going to arise because there's going to be less Spanish used.
in this part of Florida, with the Spanglish that we speak here, are younger generations not being proficient in either language?
No. People who go to school in Miami-Dade Public Schools or Broward Public Schools end up being remarkably proficient English speakers. The people that you hear who are speaking Spanish are probably people who were born elsewhere. People who are born here and go to schools here, those folks, paradoxically, end up being English-dominant bilinguals or English monolinguals. The Spanish is a different story because we don't provide access to formal Spanish in schools. We just don't. They keep it so that it's basically English monolingual medium with a so-called foreign language component, which is Spanish, that doesn't really offer bilingual kids the skills that they need.
According to the Pew Research Center, U.S. Latinos who consider their Latino identity to be very important to who they are more likely than other Latinos to say it's important for future generations to speak Spanish. They are also more likely to say that it is necessary for someone to speak Spanish in order to be considered Latino. A lot of so-called No Sabo kids are pushing back on that idea, that just because you don't know the language perfectly, that doesn't make you any less Latino. But No Sabo kids also think that knowing the language is important. So, Philip, what are your thoughts on Spanish language and identity?
I am not Latino, and so it is not my place to remark on that. But I'll tell you, in listening to my students and to the people in my research and living in South Florida for the past 14 or 15 years, it seems really unfair, especially when our society, broadly speaking, has specifically and purposefully erected barriers to the access to that language. And then to say, wait a minute, we're going to create barriers for you to get this language. We're going to expect you to simultaneously speak it and not speak it, depending on with whom and where, and so you're supposed to magically know all of that. And then if you don't get it, then you're going to be judged. It seems really unfair to then exclude people from the category of ethnicity.
That was Philip Carter, FIU professor of linguistics and English.
That was WLRN Sherilyn Cabrera speaking with Florida International University linguistics professor Philip Carter. Before we close out this edition of Capitol Report, we'd like to extend a heartfelt thank you and farewell to our colleague, Adrian Andrews. He's departing our ranks to pursue a new career path. Given the outstanding work he consistently produced while he was with us, we're confident he'll have lots of success in all of his endeavors. Thanks for everything, Adrian, and good luck. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Chris Young and Sherilyn Cabrera. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week online and on air for more reports from the state capitol.
Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. HR Florida State Council, affiliate of the Society of Human Resource Management, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 16,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council. More at hrflorida.org. The Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.